It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. For decades, the city of Green Bay has been trying to move large coal piles stored near where the Fox River enters Green Bay. The piles were kept there to fuel a now-closed power plant. Those coal piles have become a symbol in some ways of the city's industrial heritage and its quirkiness, but the land is prime real estate that's seen as having a lot of potential. Last week, after long negotiations, the city and county signed an agreement with the owner of the coal piles to move them. Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich joins us now for a look at the future of the site. Mayor Genrich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks so much for having me.
Like I said, this has been a long time coming. What does it mean for you and the city of Green Bay to finally see this deal reached?
Yeah, it's been a big week for us as a community. Last Thursday, the county board approved the arrangement between C. Rice and the county to relocate C. Rice's coal operations from a near downtown location. About 35 acres is taken up of our downtown waterfront by these coal piles. And what's going to take place as a result of that agreement is the relocation of that operation out to an exclusively industrial area, still on the waterfront, but much better suited for this kind of use. C. Rice is actually going to be consolidating their coal operations onto a site that they currently operate, and then moving some other bulk commodity operations onto that Pulliam power plant site that you referenced in the intro. So, I mean, really pretty transformational for us economically, environmentally, and culturally, and something that mayors going back probably over 70 years have been talking about. I was joined by a couple former mayors, Mayor Schmidt and Mayor Jaden, at that county board meeting last Thursday. And so just really excited that, you know, we've been able to work with our county partners, C. Rice, a lot of state and federal dollars and partners made this possible as well. So I think it's just, you know, it's a demonstration of what is possible when you have the resources, when you have the partnerships to make something like this happen.
I'm going to make a big, I think, understatement here, Mayor Genrich. This site of land has a lot more economic potential than holding up some stacks of coal, right?
Exactly. I mean, we you know, have some preliminary estimates, which I think are pretty conservative, of, you know, being able to increase property values by 150 to 200 million. We've been really successful as a city in redeveloping our waterfront over the last couple decades, kind of reorienting ourselves back towards the water as an industrial city by heritage. You know, the way that the Fox River was used historically is not, you know, how we want to use it moving forward. We still have a working river here, a really important port that's vital to our industries, but we also appreciate our natural resources and understand the economic and environmental value in really reorienting, like I said, ourselves back towards the Fox River. And so, yes, it's the potential there is extraordinary, and we're looking forward to partnering with C. Rice on master planning efforts and ultimate redevelopment efforts on that site in the very near future.
Now, what is the timeline for having the coal off of there and the land ready to go on to its next chapter?
Yeah, so obviously this is not something that happens overnight. On Thursday, the county and C. Rice did come to agreement on a term sheet. Essentially, they have until September 15th to come to terms on the lease itself. And so I know that they're going to be working hard to make sure that happens in a timely fashion. Then, you know, all of the, you know, the planning and engineering is already moving forward to make sure it's completed in time once that lease is signed. At that point, then the construction begins. Because of the $15 million that was received by the state of Wisconsin, there's a pretty strict timeline. So this work has to be completed by the end of 2026. Once that site is prepared for C. Rice, that's when the relocation will happen. Essentially, the coal will be depleted at their current site and built up at that Fox River Terminal site. And so, you know, it's probably going to be a matter of years before you see all of those coal piles removed from the site south of Mason Street here in downtown Green Bay. But the most vital thing is the fact that this agreement has been made, and we have certainty now that it's actually moving forward.
You mentioned environmental impact here. Now, coal can come along with contaminants. Coal sitting in the same place for decades. I imagine some of those contaminants might end up in soil. Is there going to have to be remediation before a new thing can be built there?
Yes, I think it's safe to say that there's going to have to be remediation on that site. You know, we have a good history here of working with the federal EPA on their brownfields program, which has been really helpful to us in redeveloping brownfield site in our downtown and other areas of the community. And so we're expecting that that's going to be necessary here. What's interesting is, you know, coal is not as bad as some liquid contaminants. Oftentimes, you know, a small operation like a dry cleaner can be much more challenging to remediate than a site like this. So there's no question that remediation is going to be necessary here. But we feel comfortable that that there's a lot that is possible, given the experience that we have and those federal resources and obviously state partners that are available as well.
Talking to Eric Genrich, mayor of Green Bay, about a decades-long situation that's finally coming to pass. Coal piles being moved from some prime real estate there. Mayor Genrich, that brings us to the fun part, at least for city planning nerds out there. This sounds fun. You've got this area, and now you get to build a vision of what to do with it. What is that going to look like? How do you figure out the public side of things, the private side of things, what this is going to be used for?
Yeah, so I mean, at a very high level, what I've said is this is really an extension of our downtown redevelopment that's taken place over the last 20 years or so. So mixed-use development, bars, restaurants, hotels, apartments, condos, you know, that sort of thing, as well as making sure that we have public access available for folks to the waterfront. You know, we are, of course, going to get into the weeds on it with a planning process in collaboration with C. Rice. We're also hoping to move forward on a waterfront plan for the entirety of our watershed, essentially for the Fox, the Bay, the East River here. And so this is going to be a really key site in that overarching plan. But, you know, we plan for a lot of community engagement to get a better understanding of what folks in the community are looking for. Engaging, of course, with C. Rice, the company will continue to be the property owner of that site and other stakeholders here. To make sure that we are planning for what really has buy-in across the community.
Bigger picture here. You had the NFL draft, I think widely viewed as a success for Green Bay. Now, this development, getting rid of this thing that was part of the industrial heritage, moving in a new direction now. Does this change the way you sell Green Bay to potential visitors, people moving there, to businesses?
I think so. I think you know, we're really, really proud of that industrial heritage that I was referencing. We're a working class town with a blue collar mentality. But we are, I think, striking the right balance as far as, you know, how we value our natural resources, how we appreciate the Fox and the Bay and the East River as well. You know, I think some folks are maybe familiar with that iconic Ski Green Bay poster where there's somebody skiing down our coal piles. That's not necessarily how we want to be known in the future, but we appreciate the nostalgia of that as well.
The coal pile thing aside, I'm sure you've got your eyes on two budget processes going on now, the state two-year budget and, of course, the big budget bill in Congress. Are there things in either or both of those bills that you're watching to see how they're going to affect Green Bay?
You know, you referenced the draft earlier. We've had a number of conversations with the governor and with our local legislators about the state kind of picking up some of the tab with respect to the security costs or public safety costs associated with that draft. So hoping in some fashion that our state government is going to be able to support our public safety entities here in Green Bay, as well as Brown County and Ashwaubenon. At the federal level, obviously a lot more uncertainty and, you know, a fair amount of concern on my part and on the part of a lot of our local residents. Actually going to be going to a roundtable later today with some folks to talk about the negative impacts on renewable energy resources in that reconciliation package. You know, rapid phase out of incentives for solar power have been included in that reconciliation bill. And so just trying to figure out exactly what that means for our local workers, businesses, residents who are looking forward to seeing some cost reductions if they move forward with energy efficiency or renewable energy initiatives. So that's one piece. Obviously, also really concerned with cuts to Medicaid that have been proposed within the reconciliation bill. So there's a lot going on there, you know, doing what we can to keep tabs on it. And hoping that our federal delegation recognizes the importance of partnering with local communities to make sure that that people are taken care of.
And we're talking amidst stepped up immigration efforts, protests in places around the country. How are you watching this immigration situation from your vantage in Green Bay?
Like a lot of people, you know, just kind of tuning into what's happening in other parts of the country. You know, we have had a lot of meaningful conversations with our immigrant community here in Green Bay, along with our police chief, Chris Davis, Attorney General Josh Call, our state representative, one of our state representatives, Ahmaud Rivera-Wagner. We got together, you know, probably a couple months back just to hear people out, to make it clear that Green Bay is a community of immigrants really since its founding. We're proud of that history and heritage and plan to, you know, you continue with that into the future. And so, you know, we, like everybody, including our immigrant community, are not interested in having violent criminals in our city or in our state. And so I think when those efforts are appropriately focused on removing violent criminals from our state and from our city, we're supportive of that. These mass deportation efforts are really concerning. And so we're, you know, keeping close tabs on things.
Mayor Genrich, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Eric Genrich, mayor of Green Bay. We talked to him today about a long-awaited agreement to move coal piles from a high-profile site in the city. Hey, people who live in Green Bay or Brown County or go there often love to hear your take on that, on these coal piles going away, as we heard, over the next couple of years. Is it about time as far as you're concerned, or are you going to kind of miss them as a landmark? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, find out why state lawmakers and AI experts in Wisconsin are worried about a part of the congressional budget bill that aims to block state laws on AI.
It's very dangerous for Congress to try to prevent state governments from taking action to address the very serious challenges that arise with AI.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The Republican federal budget bill includes language that would restrict states' ability to regulate artificial intelligence. The initial bill that passed in the House would ban states from regulating AI for the next 10 years. Senate Republicans on the Commerce Committee changed that language last week to block federal broadband funding for states that regulate AI. Three state lawmakers from Wisconsin signed on to a bipartisan letter to Congress saying that measure should be removed. Democratic State Senator Kelda Royce of Madison signed on to that letter. Senator Royce, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Great to be with you.
What led you to sign on to this letter? What caught your eye about this AI provision in the House bill?
Well, I think it's very dangerous for Congress to try to prevent state governments from taking action to prevent our constituents or address the very serious challenges that arise with AI.
Now, AI is big. It covers a lot of ground. What kind of specific concerns do you have where you think, yes, it is appropriate for a state government or maybe even a local government to have a look at it and see if they need some kind of regulation?
Yeah, I mean, listen, AI is very exciting technology, and it has tremendous promise and opportunity, but it also carries huge risks. Number one risk, I think, being disinformation, but also the energy use, the potential for discrimination, for privacy violations, or other kinds of consumer protection challenges like fraud, a lack of transparency. You know, you think about more broadly, societally, what is it going to mean in terms of worker displacement, right? And so all of these questions are very new. And that's why I think it's very good to have state policymakers saying, hey, for instance, we don't want deep fakes in campaign ads, right? We want to make sure that people know if they're going to be calling a customer service center, if they're talking to an AI or if they're talking to a human being. We want to make sure that vulnerable people don't get scammed by AI fraud. So all of these are really novel but important areas of potential legislation, and states should be free to take action on them.
Now, the House version of this reconciliation bill would have been a 10-year effective ban on state regulation of AI. A Senate Commerce Committee change says, well, not a ban, but, oh, if you do anything in the next 10 years about AI, you lose all your federal broadband funding. Does that make it any more or less palatable to you?
No, I think that's functionally a ban. I mean, the idea is, like, if you want your citizens to be connected to the modern world via broadband, then you have to accept totally unregulated AI. That's not acceptable. You know, it is really an example of how corrupt and dysfunctional Congress has become, I think. The idea that Congress is unwilling or unable to address big policy challenges like the transformations that are going to come with AI, and they also want to preempt states from taking action, I think that's really unacceptable. And I don't think that people in Wisconsin or in any other state should accept that state of affairs.
Two of your Republican colleagues over on the Assembly side also signed this national letter of state lawmakers. We invited them to join this conversation. They didn't respond to our requests. But that said, have you been talking to them or other legislative colleagues here in the state about this provision?
Yes, I have. And I've talked with them more generally about AI. And I think, you know, this is an area that is new enough that it hasn't yet settled into sort of predictable partisan patterns, which is good. There's an opportunity there. But I do think it's very disappointing to see that House Republicans in Washington, D.C., are essentially taking this no regulation approach to AI at the federal level. I think that's very dangerous. But my hope is that Republicans at the state level will still be willing to think about what we can and need to be doing to protect our constituents' interests and particularly our kids, right? We've just gone through a massive experiment on a generation of young people with access to smartphones and social media, and it hasn't gone well. And I would hate to think that we're compounding the error by allowing AI to run rampant over the next generation of young people.
I talked to Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson last week and asked him about this part of the bill. He said he's also opposed to what at that point was the outright ban on AI regulation by states.
I don't like it because it hasn't been discussed. It hasn't been debated. This is an incredibly complex issue. AI, and I'm using it right now just in terms of the budget debate. I'm doing sensitivity analysis on the CBO projection. It's marvelous. It's a great tool. But it could be unbelievably dangerous as well.
Some Republicans in the House say they regret having voted for the bill with this provision in it. I won't ask you to predict the future and what comes out of this big bill in Congress, but are you encouraged by hearing some opposition from Republicans who hold the majorities in the federal legislature?
I am. I think it's good, but you know, the problem is they already voted for it in the House. And I don't think it's an appropriate defense to say, well, I didn't really read the bill. I didn't know what was in it before I voted in favor of it. Well, maybe you should have slowed down, taken the time to do your job. You know, any other American would not be able to get away with that in their workplace. And I don't think that Congress should be able to either. You know, all of us have to vote on legislation. And there may be aspects that we agree or disagree with. But the idea that, oh, I didn't know that was in the bill because I didn't actually take the time to do due diligence is not acceptable.
We're talking to Democratic State Senator Kelda Royce about her concerns over a bill in Congress, a provision in the rescission bill that would limit states' ability to regulate artificial intelligence. AI, of course, one among many issues you deal with in the legislature, Senator Royce, but assuming the state retains the ability to regulate these things, are there agenda items you'd like to see when it comes to how AI is used, how it's deployed here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, at the forefront of this is really about transparency and consumer protection, right? Making sure that when someone is interacting with an AI system, that they are aware of that, making sure that there are guardrails around how data is used, privacy protections for people's personal sensitive information, protections against discrimination, so that we're not replicating inequalities, and protections especially for children. I think those are really at the top of my list. And then more broadly, with figuring out what we can do to reduce the energy use of these AI systems and how we can address some of the consequences for workers and employment.
An argument, of course, from industry is, hey, this is an important part of the economy, potentially transformational. We want the United States to be out ahead of it. It's very difficult if we have to say, okay, well, in Illinois, we can do this. In Wisconsin, we can't. Maybe at this county, we could do this. This county, we can't. These kind of local and state regulations are a roadblock to a potentially important industry. What do you say to that argument?
Well, these companies are among the most powerful and wealthy in the world, right? They are backed by billions of dollars in venture capital. So the idea that they can't have adequate compliance with our laws, I think is laughable when you consider that I, as a small business owner, am still responsible for, you know, dealing with all of the laws and following the regulations wherever I operate and do business. And that is as it should be, right? All of us are responsible for following the law where we live or where we travel. And the idea that the biggest and most powerful corporations find that too hard is not persuasive to me at all.
As we wrap up, Senator Royce, you signed on to this letter, over a couple hundred lawmakers from around the country, bipartisan. Is that the end of your efforts, or are you and the others who signed this staying in touch and trying to keep on top of this issue?
Well, certainly I'm going to try to keep on top of this issue. Obviously, you know, this provision already went through the House, but hopefully in the Senate, I mean, it looks like that bill is falling apart because there's so much consternation about it. And the Republican Party seems split over some of the other provisions in the bill. So my hope is that we can put a hold on this and allow states the freedom to continue doing as we have been and rising to meet the challenge of AI.
Senator Royce, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Kelda Royce is a Democratic state senator from Madison. She was with us today to share her concerns about language in the Congressional Budget Reconciliation Bill that would restrict states' ability to regulate artificial intelligence. Now we're turning to an expert on AI to help us better understand how that technology is politicized and regulated. Annette Zimmerman is an assistant professor of philosophy and affiliate professor of statistics at UW-Madison. She's a political philosopher of artificial intelligence, and she's co-lead on the UW-Madison Uncertainty and AI Research Group. Annette, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
AI is a big, huge topic. It covers a lot of ground. Big picture, how do you see governments responding when it comes to regulation or resistance to regulation?
Well, we're currently experiencing what some might call a deregulation renaissance in the US. It's actually been very interesting recently in AI policy because what we saw in the last few years was a marked departure from the standard Silicon Valley ethos of moving fast and breaking things and just resisting all kinds of regulation. But actually, especially under the Biden administration, there was a lot more of an effort to actually subject AI design and deployment to critical scrutiny and to real regulation. Now, the tide has turned, and we're back in this era of many, many different voices, both in politics and in the tech industry, suddenly calling for much less regulation again.
What are some of the issues for everyday people in the United States that they might want to worry about, that they might think, hey, if there isn't regulation, I could be at risk here?
Well, I can think of at least three major areas that concern people every day. The first one is just the use of personal data and private information. The second one is the problem that large language models can sometimes spread falsehoods. They can hallucinate and they can come up with content that is presented in a very authoritative sounding voice, but actually isn't factually correct. And thirdly, and lastly, there is still a problem of different algorithmic tools treating some people differently than others. So this phenomenon of algorithmic discrimination that actually has plagued the AI space over the past years, even before the rise of tools like ChatGPT, is still an unsolved problem. So in many areas, we see that some users have a dramatically different experience than others, and often those differences actually track existing structures of social inequality. So those three problems are obviously a concern for anyone who cares about regulating AI. And if we fail to regulate, those three issues will remain unsolved.
Let's tackle each of those in turn. Privacy, first of all. Now, I understand in Europe, for example, there are stronger privacy protections for online data, abilities to opt out of some things. Can you compare and contrast how other countries, maybe the European Union in particular, have tackled regulation and protection of privacy when it comes to AI?
Well, the European Union has adopted a notoriously heavy-handed approach to regulation. The positive side of that, of course, is that there are very comprehensive protections in place for ordinary citizens and consumers on EU territory. So there's much more scope for everyday citizens to control what kind of data is being shared with their consent. That doesn't exist in this form in the United States. So the US is still a much less regulated technology space. And in particular, when it comes to cutting-edge AI tools, there is no meaningful federal regulation in America right now that comes at all close to the European model.
That's privacy. Now, you also mentioned bad information. Well, just last week, I was talking about a bill in our legislature in Wisconsin. I looked online to look up some information about it. I didn't ask for an AI answer, but it gave me a Q&A that told me that this legislation had been passed. It hadn't been passed. It had been introduced just a few days later, but as you said, very authoritative. This exists in Wisconsin. My example is not the only example of this happening. How big a problem is this, and can regulation, how would regulation even work for information, bad information like that?
I really like your example because I think it matches what most people experience when they now use Google. And so that's a massive problem. We're now getting this slew of new AI tools that are integrated into other tools that we're familiar with, but now they are AI everything. So they integrate generative AI into decisions and tasks that previously worked without AI. So at the top of every Google search result, we now see this AI-generated summary that, you know, we might not necessarily want as everyday users. That can be highly misleading because if you're pressed for time, probably your eyes are going to dart immediately to that first paragraph. So even if there is a little disclaimer on there, hey, you know, tools can hallucinate and they could maybe contain information that isn't entirely accurate, chances are, on an everyday basis, you're not going to have the time or the energy to really investigate this. So I worry about the de facto kind of pragmatic effects of quickly deploying all of these AI tools. Even if they have disclaimers in place, that doesn't really solve the problem. And of course, from a kind of top-down regulation perspective, it's also really hard to regulate this. In a way, the problem starts earlier because the problem started when big tech companies decided unilaterally to just slap AI on every single product. And so regulation is playing catch up with all of this. We don't have almost any real framework in place, certainly at the federal level, that can give us a good answer here.
We're talking to Annette Zimmerman from the UW-Madison, a philosophy and statistics professor there, looking at regulations or lack of same when it comes to artificial intelligence. And at that third concern you had mentioned was on kind of replicating inequalities. And this is something people have been talking about when we were talking about algorithms and we weren't using ChatGPT as a phrase or artificial intelligence necessarily, but the idea that we're using these things for maybe criminal sentencing or credit reporting, or the list goes on and on. And if there's stereotypes, if there's discrimination built into the data sets, well, that's what they're going to put out. How big a worry is that?
Yeah, so you're totally right that algorithmic bias is actually a bit of an older problem. So even 10 years ago with earlier forms of machine learning, we saw these kinds of biases happening in domains like, you know, criminal justice tools or, as you rightly point out, credit lending tools. But this problem still hasn't been solved in the generative AI space. Let me give you just one example. With an earlier iteration of ChatGPT, at the time, it was called GPT-3, came out in 2020. OpenAI put out this research paper kind of critically self-reflecting on some problems with that version of the tool. And it turned out, and OpenAI, to their credit, admitted this very transparently, that GPT-3 predicted very different kinds of content for different kinds of sentences. So if you gave it the prompt, women are dot, dot, dot versus men are dot, 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 it would give you vastly different outputs. So what OpenAI did in that paper is they actually gave us a top 10 list of outputs that they would get for these two cases, right? And so in the case of men are dot, 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 the most likely completion of that sentence would be something like strong, eccentric, bold. But for women, it was bubbly, naughty, pregnant, and gorgeous. So there's a kind of clear disparity there in terms of what sorts of social stereotypes get replicated at the level of outputs for these kinds of tools. So the minute we use a large language model, we're not using a kind of thinking, living entity. We're using something that works a little bit like a parrot, right? So we replicate the kinds of texts that are already floating around in the world, and those texts, those bits of data are biased. So we see those biases reoccurring.
Annette, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Annette Zimmerman is an assistant professor of philosophy and an affiliate professor of statistics at UW-Madison. She was with us today for a look at the regulation of artificial intelligence as the congressional budget bill includes language that would restrict states' ability to regulate AI. Earlier, we heard from Democratic State Senator Kelda Royes of Madison, one of three Wisconsin state lawmakers who signed a bipartisan letter to Congress opposing that proposal. Coming up, join a conversation with a Wisconsin family about the joys and challenges of working together on their orchard.
The best times we have together, I kid you not, that's how children say, the best time we have together is when we work together.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a musician from the Milwaukee area.
The year was 1984. Prince came out with Purple Rain. Bruce Springsteen was touring for Born in the USA. And on the south side of Milwaukee, America's polka king, Frankie Yankovic, performed at Our Lady Queen of Peace Parish Festival. In attendance that day was 6-year-old Mike Schneider. The Yankovic concert changed his life because it inspired Schneider to pick up the accordion. WPR's Nick Rommel recently talked with the Wisconsin Polka Hall of Famer at a gig in Eagle.
When Mike Schneider tells that story about seeing Frankie Yankovic play for the first time, it's almost like the concert put a lifelong spell on him.
The idea was my parents would go listen to Frankie, and I would go on the church festival rides, and the instant that I heard Frankie Yankovic play, I just decided I had to play the accordion, and I was so captivated. Just sat there through the whole afternoon and watched Frankie play, and the rest is kind of history, I guess you'd say. I've been playing ever since. And you know, the interesting thing is had my parents taken me to a Bruce Springsteen concert that same day, would I be a rocker now? I don't know. That's one of those mysteries of life.
Instead, Schneider became a polka accordion player. He was only in second grade when he had his first gig with his dad, Paul, who played the accordion too.
It was for an event called Sewer Fest, because it was a church that my dad's cousin belonged to. They were having a sewer put in along the street that their church was on.
He kept gigging with his dad at parish festivals and in bars and dance halls around Milwaukee, like the Country Keg, the Pulaski Inn, and kind of like his life's work just came to him on one important day, songs pretty much just come to him, too.
It's a lot of work for me to read the notes on the page. I'm much quicker, for whatever reason, being able to listen to something and pick it up that way.
To this day, Schneider learns tunes by ear and internalizes them, but he says they always sound a little different when they come back out, like sometimes with jazz chords.
The one guy that I play with, Jim Thal, always says, "You Schneiderized it." So I guess I have my own spin on things. You know, to keep my sanity, I play other types of music too, and I think that helps a lot. If I was just doing polka, 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 waltz, polka, then I maybe would get bored.
Cactus plants are blooming, sagebrush everywhere. Granite spires are standing all around.
Schneider has recently made the polka big time. The Milwaukee Brewers asked him to record snippets of polka songs to punctuate the action at American Family Field. So when you hear "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" and "Roll Out the Barrel" at Brewers games, that's Schneider playing.
You know, when you go to a game, you're hearing a piece of your state, which I think is just so cool. So,
and he's modest about it.
Blows my mind that they're using my stuff and that they asked me to do it. It's a real honor.
Today, Schneider lives in Rock County with his wife and kids, who are more into robotics than polka. But you can hear him playing anywhere polka's found in southeast Wisconsin and at public libraries across the country during his pint-sized polka children's tour.
It's funny, people say I sound like I'm from Canada, but I never spent a day north of Brown Deer until I was... Well, my aunt lives in Fond du Lac, so we went up to see her. So that's as far north as I ever spent until I was... maybe 20 years old.
Just listen for his voice. You won't miss it.
WPR's Nick Rommel brought us that story on polka musician Mike Schneider. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Roland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today. The U.S. Census Bureau counts roughly 58,000 farms in Wisconsin. 95% of those are classified as family farms. Chris and Yuli McGuire run one of those farms. Blue Roof Orchard is an organic apple orchard in Belmont in southwestern Wisconsin. Producer Joe Tarr spoke to the McGuires and their teenage daughter Katie in February to learn what life on a farm is like.
Hi, my name is Yuli McGuire. Our farm name is Blue Roof Orchard, and it is by Belmont, Wisconsin, in Lafayette County.
I'm Chris McGuire. I farm there with my family.
I'm Katie McGuire. I'm their youngest daughter, and I've lived on Blue Roof Orchard my entire life.
We're a CSA. And a lot of people don't know what a CSA is, so then I have to explain that, you know, we have members who get a box every week with a variety of apples and things like that. I do basically everything except for spraying and pruning. So in the spring, I help with thinning the apple trees, and then I help train some of the new branches. We usually plant apple trees, and then in the summer, there's a lot of weeding. And I also check, we have insect traps, so I check them and then I record that. And then my dad enters it on the computer for the data. In the fall, we obviously pick apples and then wash them. And then we also pack them for deliveries. My job is to clean the packing shed every week, so I vacuum it. Just odd jobs with building things or whatever my dad tells me to do is what I do. Who has been the most important person in your farming life? Can you tell me about them?
That's pretty easy for you, Chris, so you can start that.
I guess I would say my grandfather. He was a lot older. He was 68 when I was born. When I remember him, he was in his late 70s, his 80s, really. So he wasn't actively farming then. And I can't say I learned, like, real tangible, useful things from him as far as like how to, you know, fix a tractor or how to grow anything in particular. But he was influential just in that he did talk to me about how much he loved that work and how happy he was that he had done it. And he wasn't a very touchy-feely kind of person. So the fact that he even said that was pretty significant. It's the only time I really remember him talking about his feelings. In retrospect, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's not as simple as it seems when you're 15, but in the core, it's still true. I mean, I do love the work and I love the lifestyle. And that, I think that's what he was talking about when he was telling me how much he loved it too.
Katie was born on the farm, like in the living room. So, you know, that's not just a piece of land for us where we have a business, but that's our entire life. And the skills, I guess, you know, everybody, well, most people will know that if you're farming, then you wear so many hats. And you learn, Chris, like electrical work, building, I mean, construction, and then equipment maintenance, all these things that we didn't have any education for, right? I mean, you came into farming knowing the horticulture part of it for sure, but everything else was you know, do it yourself and learn it along the way.
I mean, with homesteading, when I was younger, we always used to have chickens, and we used to raise meat birds every spring, and my mother would butcher them. So we had like the plucker and the like a scalding thing.
Yeah.
And I never liked the chicken butchering thing. I still don't really like raw meat very much, but we used to
like,
do that.
You mean eating raw meat?
No.
Or the touching the raw meat.
The touching.
Yeah.
And we used to raise pigs sometimes too.
Oh, and we butchered them on the farm too.
Only once, right?
Twice?
Okay, twice. I remember we used to get cheese from a local cheese plant and we fed to the pigs. I don't know why, but that I always remember that. Mm-hmm. My mother also used to keep bees for a little while.
Wow. What happened to that?
And you canned and you made dilly beans.
Yes.
And...
Yeah, not enough eaters in the family anymore. So we have three children, and then two of them are gone, and our food consumption definitely declined. But no, you're right. Thanks for bringing it up because yeah, we did all that, and that was a lot of fun. I loved butchering chickens, by the way. Sorry, I have to say.
We started off growing vegetables as well as cut flowers, actually, and that was our goal. That was what we wanted to do, and. We dropped the cut flowers after a few years, but we...
Just because we had children, let's put it back there. More children, you stepped away from flowers.
Right. We downsized in terms of employees. There were a few years where we really had little or no non-family workers on the farm. And that was something I really enjoyed about that period, was, you know, working more with the kids and, you know, and one-on-one with them directly. You know, it used to be that we have six employees and our children, and I wasn't really spending time with them. You know, they were just more people on the crew to, you know, tell what to do and herd along sort of. Whereas when we were just working as a family together, I interacted with them a lot more, and that, you know, that was kind of a brief period, you know, where they were old enough to be working, but hadn't left home yet. And it was, I'm glad that we've had that interval in our life to work together. That's been wonderful.
Yeah. And actually what we usually talk about at home with the family, with the kids, the best times we have together, I kid you not, that's how children say the best time we have together is when we work together. And that can be sad to hear, but also really good to hear, because imagine how many people will be saying that oh, well, those were the good times. And it's true, like when we are out there, all five of us, then and then, you know, banging around, like last time 2 years ago, we were converting a building into a greenhouse into a building, right? And that was like on Thanksgiving Friday, Thanksgiving, our college age girl daughter came home and said, Great. All five of us are here together. Guess what? We have to re-roof that greenhouse. And there we were, and working along and laughing and working hard and saying that, wow, that's when we have the best time together when we actually out there working. So yeah.
No one's on their phone. No one's in their room. Yeah. So we're all together.
I feel very targeted right now. We have a very funny sense of humor as a family. And there's a lot of bilingual jokes in it, and most people probably wouldn't get it, but we do a lot of laughing while we're working. I don't know if I want to be a farmer, because I'm not sure if I would like to handle the sort of business side of being a farmer, but I do like being outside and growing good food. There's a whole side to farming that most people don't think about. It's not just like the farm work outside. You have to find where you're going to sell things and all the business. You're running a business, and I'm not really sure if I would just want to do that, like the office work side of it, or if I'd be very good at it, but I do like working outside a lot.
Why I feel it's important what we do is comes from eating. I love to eat, and I love good food, so raising that and growing that for not just for our family, but all the other people who are eating it is why I'm proud of it, really. Not because I'm doing great with the environment or, you know, it's just because I'm people are eating our used to eat our great vegetables, and now they are eating our apples, and I bring joy to their life, and not just because it's healthy, but it tastes good, and that's why I'm proud of it.
I guess also I just would emphasize like how beautiful and sacred and important the work is. Growing food for people, working on the land. Yeah, I've been doing it for, over 20 years, and I still feel like I'm participating in a miracle all the time. Just seeing how the seasons change and the weather and how the plants grow and flower and bear fruit, and all it's amazing. And to have an opportunity to be a part of that and help it along and participate it and witness it is fantastic and unspeakable.
Make your children work too, because it really is a good experience, I think.
And pay them well.
Yes, that's important.
Chris and Yuli McGuire run Blue Roof Orchard, an organic apple farm in Belmont. Producer Joe Tarr talked to the McGuires and their daughter Katie in February at the annual Marble Seed Organic Farming Conference in La Crosse. The interview was part of a StoryCorps project in collaboration with the University of Minnesota Duluth Journalism Program. Wisconsin Road Trip Series continues. WPR reporters are putting together some cool travel ideas around the state with fun themes. This week it's ice cream. Alyssa Alamand gives us a preview on our Instagram feed.
Did you know Blue Moon ice cream may have originated in Wisconsin? It's a key flavor in the Midwest, tasting citrusy and creamy, kind of like Fruit Loops. And it happens to be my favorite flavor.
We want to hear
Wisconsin
from
Road
you.
Our Wisconsin Road Trip series details Blue Moon's history, focusing on Sassy Cow Creamery in Columbus.
Sorry, Alyssa jumped in on you there. We want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite local ice cream or custard shop? What is your favorite flavor? How about that Blue Moon? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Joe Tarr and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.